Okay. Previously, I attempted to motivate a certain view of the grounds of ethically significant action. Integral to this view is the claim that what makes a certain action ethically significant is not whether it has been efficiently caused by some sort of psychological mechanism internal to an agent, independently of outside influences. I am not denying that freedom in that sense is possible or that it isn't a necessary condition for ethical action. My concern is that the emphasis on that sort of condition for ethically significant action disposes us to miss what is really important in this vicinity. Whether or not our wills operate as independent, efficient causes makes no difference for how we raise our children, train our future colleagues, or plan our lives in deliberation with our neighbors. Rather, an ethically significant action is a performance that has a special sort of relationship to a form of life. Specifically, an ethically significant action is justified by a commitment to a certain set of goods that together constitute the good life, or it is something that the doing of which commits one to such a view of what really matters. Ethically significant actions are those doings for which one can give reasons, wherein reasons are justifications in terms of goods of ultimate concern, acting in accord with a vision of what really matters most in a human life. The perceptive member of the audience will have already noted that I am suggesting that we worry less about something pushing us from behind as an efficient cause, and instead wonder about what exactly pulls us toward it as a final cause. What we want from our children, colleagues, and neighbors is that they be motivated by certain goods that constitute our shared form of life. I also tried to show you how our relationship to these reasons for our ethically significant actions is often, maybe in most of the really important cases, only retrospectively accessible. That is, when I am doing the things that most express or constitute the sort of life to which I am committed, the connection between those actions and their ultimate reasons is quite often not entirely transparent to me. Indeed, even the very goods that compose the form of life we are thrown into are often not entirely within our ken when we need most to decide in favor of them. Until we reach a certain station in life when retrospective reflection is possible, our reasons for acting are mostly carried by our participation in histories, both cultural and biological, and institutions that we have inherited. Because I'm an organic product of a natural history, a member of a family, an inheritor of a language and a culture, etc., certain reasons are my reasons for acting, even though I might as yet have failed to make those reasons explicit to myself or anyone else. And maybe I will never be able to do so. Throughout much of our lives, we depend on others, both particular others with whom we share bonds of friendship, and institutional others, providing context within which those bonds of friendship may be established, who have gone before us to provide the reasons for our most ethically significant actions. I take it that this is part of what Aristotle had in mind when he famously claims, "A man alone is a beast or a god." We humans, however, are not robots. We can make our reasons explicit. We can, upon reflection, decide that our reasons for acting were not particularly good reasons for acting, and the actions that followed on them were subsequently not the right things to have done. We can amend our long-term dispositions for action based on these reflections, though only with a great deal of effort. We can further subject our inherited form of life to critical reflection, and even come to the conclusion that it is flawed and possibly requiring substantial revision or even wholesale rejection. Rational conversion is a real possibility. We humans are unique in that we are capable of reflective self-criticism of both our particular actions and the ways of life we suppose to justify them. The process of becoming capable of this sort of self-criticism is ethical education in the most important sense. And it culminates, even if never fully complete, in practical wisdom. Our achievement of wisdom will, for the most part, come late in life, a skill mostly exercised retrospectively, while looking back upon our own ethically significant decisions and providing reasons on behalf of our juniors who are now trotting similar paths. Once again, I take it that this Monday morning quarterbacking phenomenon in our exercise of practical wisdom is part of what Aristotle had in mind when he claimed that happiness, our satisfaction at having lived our form of life well, only comes from the perspective of one's deathbed. Certainly, we have to see how things wrap up ultimately for our projects before we can deem ourselves happy. But we also don't really know how to evaluate those very projects until we have been made wise by carrying them out. Notice that the wise person is someone who is able to take responsibility for both her actions justified by her form of life and that form of life itself. Since we are capable of reflective self-criticism, we have a sort of ownership of our actions. The wise person sits on his deathbed and looks back over his life and can say, "I understand why that has all been done, and for good or ill, I accept responsibility for it." One might say we are free beings. I see freedom in this sense as a threefold responsibility. We are able to make the connection between our actions and goods that constitute our form of life that would hopefully justify them explicitly. Those goods really do constitute a worthy form of life, and those goods really are our reasons for acting. In other words, a free person is someone who has entered into what Wilfred Sellers famously calls the logical space of reason. A person can give legitimate justifications for her sayings and doings. Someone who satisfies these conditions has moved from being a default participant in the biological and cultural activities of a certain form of life to someone who can give explicit justifications of those activities in terms of real goods enshrined as most mattering to those who live that way. The important contrast to highlight here is between activity and passivity. The denizen of the logical space of reasons does not piggyback on the reasons of others, but has come to take active responsibility for her actions by offering sincere justifications. The free person has reached a point of maturity by moving beyond a passive role of accepting the implicit justifications on offer from her form of life to an active role of reflectively and critically making explicit those justifications. Part and parcel of this movement from passivity to activity is a willingness to revise one's activities where justifications are found wanting. Surely any bona fide denizen of the logical space of reasons takes reasons to be normative in the sense that the presence or absence of justifications has consequences for practical commitment. The first condition for freedom is a sort of responsibility internal to one's form of life. For Cormac to give explicit justifications of this sort, the goods he cites must actually be the goods of his form of life, and they must be actually connected to his actions in the appropriate way. In short, part of what freedom requires of Cormac is that he be responsible to the form of life he has been thrown into. For example, if Cormac were to justify and not merely piggyback on the justifications of others, his decision to marry in terms of his Roman Catholicism, he would need to grasp the goods Catholicism takes as inherent to marriage. His marrying this particular woman would have to be appropriately connected to those goods so as to plausibly bring them about, and he would need to be acquainted with this connection. Using the term loosely, we might think of this condition for freedom as a sort of syntactical responsibility, as it requires the explicit grasp of formal and material logical connections between the sorts of actions available and the justifying goods. The free person makes valid moves in the logical space of her form of life. We might then think of the second condition as a sort of semantic responsibility. Here, Korbach is not just responsible to his way of life, but he's responsible to the world as it really stands. That is, if a proposed set of goods is to justify Cormac's decision to marry, then those goods must not be merely proposed as good, but must really be good. A justification for acting in terms of a merely apparent good, as opposed to a real good, about what really matters in life is not a justification for acting, but self-harm. long-term, maybe irreducible delusions about what really constitutes our good. It's how Aristotle defines the very notion of vice. And he sees it as tantamount to self-destruction in its extreme forms. Thus, we are not only responsible to our form of life, but we are responsible for it. A free being checks her understanding of the good against the world. A cult is not a form of life, and therefore a free person cannot shirk ultimate semantic responsibility. If we think of the two conditions for freedom as demands for responsibility to others, the free person is responsible to the others from whom she has inherited her form of life and with whom she shares the world. We should take the third as a demand for responsibility to oneself, a kind of authenticity. Maybe Cormac's particular decision to marry might instantiate the appropriate connection to the goods prescribed by his Catholic way of life, and that way of life may constitute an actual way of human flourishing. Nevertheless, that could all be coincidental to what Cormac is actually up to, because those goods are not what really motivate him. Though Cormac's decision to marry could be justified by bona fide goods of human unity, family and salvation, he might, deep down, as it were, really be motivated by lust, status, money, or what have you. In the latter case, Cormac would be responsible to and for his way of life only accidentally, which is to say he is not acting responsibly at all. If Cormac's actions in such a case were justifiable in terms of this form of life, he would be merely lucky. And the movement from being lucky to being ethically responsible is the very mark of human freedom. We don't raise our children so that they might be accidentally good, but to be good on purpose. Maybe we begin the process of educating someone in a way of life by motivating them by the external goods just to get things off the ground. But full, mature practice requires that one, to some high degree at least, be motivated by the goods internal to the way of living. Thus, whereas the first two conditions require that the free person can make explicit the connection between her actions and the goods constitutive of her form of life, and the hopefully veridical connection between the latter and the world, the third condition requires that she can bring her own true motives to explicit transparency. Her satisfaction, the first two conditions, is not merely an act of bad faith. In this light, we can see that the threefold responsibility conditions for freedom entail a corresponding threefold set of knowledge conditions for freedom. That is, freedom requires knowledge of one's way of life. One must know what one is committed to in her way of life and how those commitments are related to particular courses of action on offer. One must have knowledge of the world. One must know whether, in knowing the goods she is committed to in her way of life, she in fact knows how the world actually stands. And one must have knowledge of oneself. One must know whether it really is a commitment to a bona fide vision of the good life that motivates his acting, rather than some other, possibly insidious motive. Thus, freedom follows on responsibility, but responsibility follows only on knowledge. Or as I put it earlier, we achieve our freedom inasmuch as we have achieved a certain type of wisdom, knowing our way of life, knowing the world, and knowing ourselves. We can see that the great threat to our freedom is not the impingement of efficient causes, but ignorance. Our freedom is undermined when we don't know what we are doing. We don't know whether what we are doing is actually a good idea, or we don't really know why we're doing what we're doing. Whatever might obscure our vision in these matters subverts our freedom. Indeed, if you wanted most easily to force someone's hand in some way, the most efficient means to that end would not be literal force, say efficient causation, but the provision of obfuscating information, imposed ignorance. If freedom is wisdom, then bondage is ignorance. I will spend the rest of our time today discussing one of these possible subversions of freedom by ignorance. Specifically, I will focus on the possibility of our self-ignorance as a bar to freedom. You might find that to be an odd selection. Surely the crisis in real cultural education and a generalized skepticism about our ability to get the world right, except in the narrowest scientific terms, imperil our self-understanding as free and rational beings. I agree that we often do not understand what we are up to, and we have lost confidence in achieving objectivity regarding the good life. Those self-imposed states of ignorance, though they are bad enough in their own right, pale as threats to our achievement of freedom. More insidious is a sneaky and increasing distrust in our ability to achieve any sort of transparency regarding our motives. That may sound odd. What could be less obscure to me than my own motives? Concern, however, about the transparency of our inner motivations is central to classical understandings of ethical reflection from the very inception of that tradition. Consider how the tragic drama we find in the Greeks reveals the threat a distorted understanding of our own motivations poses to our ultimate well-being. The most obvious example is Sophocles' character Oedipus. In terms of the first two conditions of responsibility, Oedipus acts magnificently, at least in terms of the form of life he inherited as an ancient Greek. Slaying an arrogant brigand on the road, taking a beautiful widowed queen as your wife, and saving your city from plague by an act of wit are paradigmatic instances of being responsible to and for that particular way of life. Rather, what leads Oedipus to ruin is a systematic distortion of his understanding of who he is and what ultimately accounts for his deepest motives. He fails utterly in terms of authenticity or responsibility to himself. This may even be a willful ignorance, as Oedipus knew well the prophecy of his patricide and incest, and the reader cannot help but find it hard to believe that he might never have noticed an odd resemblance between himself and his wife, nor the odd coincidence that he had just so happened to kill a stately figure on his way to meeting her, etc., etc. Surely Sophocles does not expect us to be utterly incredulous towards Oedipus's thin appearance as innocent. It seems then that Oedipus had, prior to the revelations in the drama, completely failed to put himself under any sort of significant rational scrutiny. It was that possibly willful self-ignorance that accounts for Oedipus's terrible ruin. Tragedy is not merely the operation of fate in our lives that might bring us to an ill end, even though we have made the best possible efforts to the contrary. Rather, I see tragedy as a result of a failure to take responsibility for oneself. By not examining yourself, that is, your true motives, you leave your life to the play of fate. If things come out well for you, that will be merely accidental, as you have never taken possession of yourself. Even if Oedipus really did kill a brigand, save the city, and marry the beautiful queen, all great deeds, he is no better than an incestuous patricidal maniac, because he falls into the former category rather than the latter only by luck. For all he knew, and that's maybe overstated, but for all he knew, though he easily could have known better, he was really a complete lout. Why didn't Oedipus ever put two and two together regarding the curious series of events that form the most pivotal events of his life, the curiousness of which are so blatantly obvious to the reader or any impartial observer of his life? One can only conclude that ultimately Oedipus did not want to face hard questions about himself, and therefore his ultimate motives are dubious indeed. It is no accident that Sophocles has the tidings of Oedipus's horrifying wrongdoings originate from the Oracle of Delphi, where the motto, "Know thyself," was inscribed, and Socrates claimed to have learned the unexamined life is not worth living. Sophocles, on my reading, goads us to ask of Oedipus, really? What have you really actually been up to, Oedipus? And to see that failure to ask such a question of ourselves will lead to ruin. Maybe it is no accident that Friedrich Nietzsche aspired to rekindle the worldview of Greek tragedies by applying a generalized, subversive cultural self-criticism. Nietzsche's critique of Christian morality and his genealogy of morals is the paradigmatic instance of what he has in mind. Whereas the reflective Christian claims to engage in certain practices, charity, chastity, forgiveness, for the sake of the common good or the other, Nietzsche proposes a counter-narrative in which these claims are merely masks for deeper subconscious motives for revenge, domination, and hatred. He supports this proposal with a just-so retelling of history in which a group of weaklings wrought by Resentiment, originally the Levite priesthood but later led by the cruel genius St. Paul, concoct an ad hoc system of value that puts them as weaklings on top against the truly great strongmen, ultimately Romans for Nietzsche, by the painful imposition of the ultimate psychological weapon, guilt. According to Nietzsche, the Christian says she engages in charity out of true love for neighbor, but she is really moved by hatred and desire for torturous revenge on those stronger than she. Of course, Nietzsche's genealogy of morals is one of the wildest conspiracy theories in history, and is presented almost completely devoid of any evidence to support the conclusion that this is how things actually occurred. I doubt these facts are lost on Nietzsche, and I think he is actually trying to make a different kind of point. He is not trying to prove a certain account of the origin of Christianity, but to suggest the possibility of the obscurity of our motives. After encountering Nietzsche's genealogy head on, I bet few people have really emerged without asking themselves, why do I really believe all of this anyway? What do I really want out of this? I see Nietzsche as asking the Christian and the secular humanist of the Enlightenment he equally mistrusts to follow the mandate of the oracle and know thyself. Whatever we think of Nietzsche's multi-millennial conspiracy theory of resentful Jews exacting a nihilistic revenge on a mystical Aryan aristocracy, we cannot deny that genealogical subversion has become one of the default modes of discourse in our public dialogue. I absolutely abhor philosophers masquerading as armchair sociologists, but please permit me just one indulgence. Okay. Turn on your preferred cable news channel tonight, and you are likely to see accusations along these lines. You say you want to keep schools closed to protect children, but we really know you're only trying to undermine the election. Or you claim that you oppose same-sex marriage for the sake of public goods, but it's really obvious that you are simply masking your own inner fear of being homosexual. Sound familiar? We seem to deliberate now primarily by genealogical subversions of other people's motives, attempting to subvert confidence in their explicit justifications of their actions by proposing possible, less flattering, subterranean motives. I suspect we have all felt the sting of the ubiquitous Nietzschean acid that fuels much of our political and academic discourse. Can you really say that a nearly 24/7 exposure to genealogical subversion has left your own confidence in your motives entirely intact? Notice, however, that the many genealogies that fill the discursive swamp in which we are currently mired are no less the products of conspiratorial just-so stories and uncharitable interpretations completely unhinged from anything like an evidential base than were the speculations behind Nietzsche's original invention of the genre. Moreover, our cable news genealogists rarely force us to face up to the kinds of subtle and important questions about ourselves, as does Nietzsche. None of that is to say, however, that we should be too quick to assume we are in good order with respect to the self-knowledge condition of freedom. Not all grounds for questioning our motives are based on anti-Semitic conspiracy theories or shallow partisan politics expressed through tweets and clickbait headlines. There is, in fact, a good bit of scientific evidence drawn from a broad spectrum of fields that should lead us to wonder how transparent our own reasons for acting are to ourselves. For example, there is a significant finding in which experimental subjects were divided into teams by what they knew to be arbitrary means. I believe it was a coin toss. As soon as these subjects were asked to compete in simple games, they showed a tendency towards highly competitive actions, even cheating, in order to defend what they now took to be their superior group. Moreover, evolutionary psychologists have done much to show that the ability to separate other humans into convenient in-groups and out-groups likely played a very large role in the original development of the human personality and influences our group identifications to this day. In light of that sort of evidence, how confident can you be regarding the rational nature of your allegiance to any single group? Is our allegiance something rationally grounded, or a convenient grouping that allows for an easier prosecution of our material interests? Clearly, such a distortion is something that threatens our deliberations. Other results from social psychology have shown a distressing role of various biases in our judgments regarding other people. For example, one famous study showed that resumes with traditionally African-American names consistently received less interview interest than those with the exact same qualifications, but headed with traditional European names. There are other studies showing that whites tend to interpret black faces as angrier than white faces, given the same expression, and still others showing that college professors are much more likely to respond to emails signed with traditionally European names as opposed to traditionally African-American names. Moreover, instruments such as the Harvard Implicit Bias Test have shown rather distressing levels of racial, gender, religious, and other forms of biases in the cognitive backgrounds of people who consciously would not identify themselves as racist, sexist, or otherwise bigoted. In this light, how certain can you be, without explicit scrutiny, that you have really operated freely from unfounded biases when making judgments about the abilities or character of other people? Other social psychological studies have shown that people who have found a coin in a phone booth, this is my favorite, by the way, people who found a coin in a phone booth are overwhelmingly more likely to help someone who has dropped a folder full of loose papers than those who have not been so fortuitous to have obtained a quarter. And whether someone is willing to help another person by changing a bill is strongly influenced by the presence of the smell of fresh bakery in a shopping mall. Yeah. A famous study shows that a group of seminarians who had been, I think they're Protestant by the way, a study showed a group of seminarians who had been tasked with getting across town in order to give a talk on the parable of the Good Samaritan could be predicted on the likelihood of stopping and helping someone in dire distress based on how hurried they were to get from the one place to the other. It seems that what moved them was not their consciously held moral principles, as outlined in the parable, but their need to be on time. In light of these studies, how certain are you of your conscious stories about why you have decided to help or not to help somebody? These deliverances of the social sciences, and I have only mentioned a few among many more available, clearly show that there are likely distortions of our self-understandings that leave us subject to tragedy in the classical sense. Unwittingly subjecting ourselves to the play of fate. Notice, however, that I do not say that the social sciences threaten our freedom. Rather, my point is that a confrontation with what the social sciences show us about ourselves and what might really be motivating our actions is a necessary step in our achieving true human freedom. We can only begin to expunge our dangerous cognitive blind spots by first exposing the most dangerous kinds of ignorance we have about ourselves. As Alistair MacIntyre puts it, quote, education in the virtues consists in key part in making those so educated aware in detail of the possibilities of error and of the errors which each of them will be particularly inclined because of temperament or social role or whatever. Here the traditional insights of Aristotelian Thomism need to be enriched by more recent findings, end quote. From MacIntyre, today the Oracle of Delphi calls us to his term, sociological self-knowledge that amounts to, quote, a grasp of the nature of roles and relationships in which one is involved, of the shared assumptions of those with whom one interacts, of what those roles, relationships, and assumptions obstructs the exercise of rational agency, and of what the possibilities are of acting so as to transform them, end quote. Failure to take seriously what the social sciences show us about our condition, especially what we otherwise could not know about ourselves, looms as a self-imposed ignorance no less likely to bring us to ruin than Oedipus's deluded understanding of his own actions. Of course, we are not likely threatened by anything so stark as unwitting acts of patricide and incest, but it is not too far better to be led by self-ignorance to participation in systems of racism, sexism, xenophobia, homophobia, and many other likely forms of exploitation and bigotry. A bit of subversive genealogy is not a bar to our moral freedom, but likely a tool we need to deploy against our own tendencies towards self-delusion. Notice, however, I say a bit of subversive genealogy. Our genealogical self-criticism must be limited, not global in scope. the 800-pound gorilla in the room of much popular postmodernism is that a globalized genealogical attitude will inevitably violate the first rule of tree trimming. That is, never saw the branch you are standing on. Okay. Thanks to Mark Johnson for the metaphor. That is, if all of my judgments about my motives are subject to genealogical subversion, then it would seem that my motive for trusting the deliverances of the social sciences that reveal my hidden motives would themselves be subject to subversion. And now we are unable to make any judgment at all. No, the genealogist, unless like Nietzsche he is willing to accept a position beyond making sense, must presume that there is some stance that is immune to genealogical subversion. Maybe I cannot know absolutely whether I have achieved such objectivity of self-knowledge, but the rationality of the very project of achieving freedom presumes that getting myself right is a possibility. Let's not, however, be too quick to move past this problem. If I am subject to self-delusion, then how am I ever to trust myself in overcoming self-delusions? Couldn't whatever revision of my understanding of my own motives that I opt for be itself just one more convenient bias and evasion of the ugly realities of my true desires? Well, sadly, yes. But this is where friendship comes into play. Again, McIntyre, quote, "But our self-knowledge too depends in key part upon what we learn about ourselves from others. And it's insofar as I am overprotective of myself in resisting disclosure to just such others that I am liable to become a victim of my own fantasies," end quote. In other words, I need critique by others in order to achieve self-knowledge, to liberate myself from my self-aggrandizing fantasies. I myself am unlikely to achieve an objectivity about my actions and motives for them simply by an introspective awareness. We are subject, like Oedipus, to our own possibly incorrigible self-imposed ignorances on ourselves. Other people, however, are not distorted by our own personal shortcomings, so they must be our source of self-criticism. Notice that McIntyre emphasizes the fact that our resistance of disclosure is one of the primary obstacles to overcoming our self-imposed delusions. That is, I cannot consider the other's critique of my doings and motives until I have honestly disclosed myself to her. Honest disclosure, however, only occurs in a context of trust and mutual goodwill, which is to say, it is on our friends whom we depend to provide us with limited genealogical subversions of our own convenient biases. Who better than my wife to tell me, "We both know you have long envied Smitty's success, and that is why you are considering voting against his promotion." Genealogical subversion is a necessary, though dangerous, drug that carries many terrible side effects unless administered properly. The proper application of this powerful therapy is a context of love and trust, where we know the point of the critique is not to undermine our personality as we know it, but to help us avoid tragic self-destruction. As McIntyre puts it, the best protection against our most grievous errors are, in his phrase, friendship and collegiality. I must be able to trust you to tell me the truth that I most need to hear, however painful that subsequent self-realization may be. And I need to trust you to do me no harm in your pronouncements on my character. There is a ring of paradox in the view of freedom I am sketching for you, at least to our modern ears, though I doubt that Aristotle, St. Thomas, Hegel, or Wittgenstein would hear the slightest irony. We associate the notion of freedom with independence, and I have highlighted this in the emphasis I have put on freedom as a kind of responsibility. The free person is someone who can take responsibility for her sayings and doings, responsibility to her form of life, for her form of life, and to herself. By offering sincere justifications and certainly responsibility is a kind of independence. If I am to become responsible for my sayings and doings, then I am able to exercise practical rationality in offering the relevant justifications independently. The free person no longer piggybacks on other people's reasons for her ethically significant actions. We begin dependent on others to carry our reasons, but our freedom is the achievement of an independent ownership of those reasons. Notice, however, that responsibility to myself, purging myself of delusions about my true motives, requires that I admit a special kind of dependence I have on others. I must submit myself to others and trust that they are both wise and good-willed. My freedom can only be achieved inasmuch as I can depend on trusted friends. And the idea that I can one day free myself entirely from the creeping temptation of self-delusion is a dangerous fantasy. I will always be beholden to my friends, to some degree or other, to spot my own lies to myself. Freedom is then a kind of independence that is always parasitic on a kind of dependence. And our path towards wisdom is always one we will walk shoulder to shoulder with our friends in a shared fear and trembling. Thank you.